Accession number 27804, Squadron Commander Ian Blair, Reel 15. Now, we were talking about the end of your tour, really. But I believe you've got a couple more incidents you want to tell us about.
Well, there's only a couple. Rather important, actually. Basically, one was, I can't remember the dates because I haven't got my logbook, but it was a night flight, a night operation, which the CO selected me as his navigator stroke bomber. And we took off. It was about 4 hours. We did a cross-country from Martin Bagush, of course, all in the desert. And we flew south into the desert and turned right and eventually flew north. The target was Al Adam Airfield. And aerodrome was it an airfield? It was a late takeoff, and we had some trouble with the downward identification lights and the navigation lights on the way out. But the other aircraft, which had gone off at the same time, gave us the okay, or gave the CO the okay that everything was in order. We managed to rectify the switching gear on the. So that we assumed that everything was in order, and off we took, way down to the south, due west. And
I should ask the CO. Is this Collish? Who is
no,
the CO?
No, this was Barney Kyle, Squadron of Kyle, our CO.
Right. Sorry,
I hadn't flown with him often, but
you mentioned one of the mission with him. Yeah. So it's Barney Kyle. Sorry, you carry on. I'll go.
Yeah. He was doing the op. And he and I, and the idea was to bomb Al Adam. The bomb load, if I remember, was the usual thing of incendiary bombs and fragmentation bombs. The object exercise was that we would approach Al Adam from the south and bomb the hangars and come home. So we did just that, actually. We did a long cross-country and, well, cross-country, inverted commas, but we approached Al Adam from the south, and we were flying about 500 feet or thereabouts, a low-level attack. And as we ran up on this target, literally, as the phrase goes, all hell was let loose. There was more flaming onions and flak and stuff, which we had never seen at night before in these days. It was all very strange. And I ducked, and the CO remembers me ducking, and when he said when he got back, anyway, we had a very hot reception, and I dropped all the bombs, but I missed the target. But the bombs all, instead of hitting the hangar, they all fell along the apron outside the hangar and left a fiery glow. Don't suppose there was very much damage done. But then when we got back, we realized, the nighttime, of course, realized what was the trouble was, why the flak was so accurate. When we got back, we were burning our station keeping lights. So that wasn't a very good start. It was near. But anyway, you learn by your mistakes. But the CO just laughed it off. And he laughed it off because when the flak came up, I instinctively ducked, and he'd seen me duck. Anyway, that was one incident. The other incident, I don't know if I mentioned it, was about the submarine Nantes.
You mentioned about the submarine depot.
Yeah,
ship.
Won't repeat that again. That was the two main items. So we fast forward to the end of the incident with the Derna, and that was the culmination of my operations, because I was then sent off. I was about 2 weeks afterwards. I was sent off on a flying course.
Now, where did you have to go for that?
Yeah. Just before I got, I got myself really uptight, because in the period between the incident and my actual departure was about 14 days, which I didn't do any operation. So obviously I was relegated to my trade as armourer. And I came up against some of these young pilot officer aircrew types, not pilots, but bomb aimers, and somewhere around the armory, and I really got furious, because they were talking to me about something or other, and I was relating the procedure or whatever, and some guy made a caustic remark to me. He said, well, don't you No, there's a war on, or was that effect, which made me somewhat livid, having just done a complete tour. However, nothing came of it. It just shrugged it off and took umbrage and got on with the job. So the posting came, and I was posted to 23 EFTS, Elementary Flying Training School. 23, I thought to myself, where is 23 EFTS? So it ultimately transpired it was in Nairobi. So in due course, I was given instructions to board an Imperial Airways flying boat at Cairo. It happened to be the Canopus Empire flying boat, and in civilian clothes, and carrying all my gear, certainly my personal kit, etc., but travel in civilian clothes with a civilian passport, which I already had been given from the abortive attempt to return to UK on the 3rd of September 39. But so anyway, the passport was still valid. And I took off, and we flew up the Nile via Khartoum and Wadi Halfa, seemed to landing at these places en route to refuel. And then the last leg was across the Bundu, across the country to Impala on Lake Victoria, where we stayed the night there at Impala, landing on the lake. But the thing was that trip across from the Nile across to Lake Victoria was done at low level in these days, 500 feet, and in daylight, and it was fantastic because we were observing all the wild animals, which we don't see any, herds of cattle, and it's a thing that I should never forget. We don't see them anymore because there are not so many great herds. But we landed at Impala, stayed the night in the Palace Hotel, which was out of this world, having come off the desert. It really was. It was a beautiful building, all marble. It was done for the, I suppose, the tourists predominantly. Yeah, it must have been tourists. Immaculate. The staff were all dressed in long galabeers. But there I was as a civilian with all the other few people that were there. Don't remember many of them. But we stayed the night there, and the following day they flew us along to Kisumu, which is another stop along the northern ledge of the Lake Victoria. I can't remember how long it was. It was quite some distance, but we stopped at this. I got off at Kisumu. That was my destination. So I was off, and I was put in a local hotel in Kisumu. I was there 3 days. And what fascinated me about Kisumu, very laid back, it was in Kenya by this. This was Kenya. This hotel was marvelous, a nice, cool room, excellent food. And the thing that impressed me, one was the bananas. I'd never seen bananas for such a long time. They were short, fat bananas. They were probably about 6 inches short and straight. And it must have been about 2 inches, 2.5 to 2 inches in diameter. And they just dissolved in your mouth. They're absolutely beautiful. I stayed there for 3 days. The other great thing there was that at the bottom of the drive, there had a monumental milepost, a signpost, which stood probably about 12, 13 feet high. But it had arms pointing at all points of the compass, and the top one was, of course, London, something like 3,000 miles that away, you know, Australia in the opposite direction. But I've got some photographs of this. But so the next phase of the exercise, having spent 3 days waiting for, I think I must have been waiting for a train, actually, and we got on this wood-burning Garrett locomotive. You know, I don't know if everyone knows what Garrett is. It looks the same both ways. It's a great big, it's a steam engine chassis, basically. It's got a front and rear tenders, so to speak, but it's all one piece. And they chunted this thing along the line and eventually arrived at, it took a long time to get to Nairobi. I was then, when I got to Nairobi, I was posted to Eastleigh. Well, when we arrived at Eastleigh, there were one or two barrack blocks.
Where's Eastleigh's? Just outside Nairobi.
Eastleigh, Nairobi, and Eastleigh.
Is it spelled the same way as the...
Pardon?
How's it spelled? Is it
E-A-S-T-L-E-I-G-H.
Yeah. Same way as the English.
Same as... yeah, I remember getting there. I can't remember how I got from the... But obviously it must have been taken. But I was taken to Eastleigh, and I was given a billet in the... in the block, and there was a block there, and they authorised me to retain my acting sergeant. I was still in a billet, although I wasn't. I really lost the stripes afterwards, but that was routine. But when I got to Eastleigh, the only permanent building there was the sick quarters. I remember that quite vaguely, but we were residents with the South African Air Force. They were there, and the sergeant's mess, inverted commas, was an aircraft packing case. I quite remember that, actually. But I was still a sergeant. I was allowed to use the sergeant's mess. I got chatting to these South African Air Force people, and they had ferry battles. Ferry battles on the standing on the tarmac, and Furies... Hawker Furies, single seaters, lovely, beautiful aircraft. I managed to get myself into one of these aircraft. Marvelous, touch of the World War One stuff, you know. But the thing about the South Africa, all the bullet holes on the ferry battles had been patched, and they had the dates on them. Quite impressed because they told me there about the raid they mounted using. A Valencia aircraft and a 45-gallon drum packed with explosives, which was literally pushed out the door. I heard about that there. I didn't really believe it, but it is a fact that it did happen, and I read about it somewhere in a book subsequently. But that was what. But these guys were all South Africans, not army. Well, all cocky. They're nice guys. So I was joined at this course and this flying trip. It was 23 FTS, EFTS, with a number of the locally recruited aircrew, LAC aircrew. These guys were all residents. They were all, nearly all British. Well, British, I suppose, bulk of them. But they were sons of big game hunters, lawyers, tea planters. They were highly motivated, and I think one guy was the son of a lord of the a knight of the realm, or whatever they called him. Cowley was his name, a little short, fat guy, but he was. They were all very intelligent people, but they were very boisterous. You know, they'd been used to very active life, but nevertheless, we were introduced as a group. All, I think 18 or 20 of us, can't quite remember the number. Maybe it was more than, no, it was about that, 18 or 20. And we were then introduced to the CO, who was classified as a major, and he had been, it was what they call the Kenya Air Unit, a sort of civilian flying club type of organization. But the point was, he was the CO, and we were allocated an instructor, and my instructor was a sergeant, I remember him, Sergeant Lepore Trench. The name rings a bell, but Lepore Trench. I think he was some... Lepore Trench. I think the family name as well is quite famous in South Africa, but the major... inverted commas, who was the CO, was a former member of the local airlines, Kenya Airways or something, which was wound up as a result of the war, but he got this job as well. However, the important thing is that Nairobi is 5,000 feet above sea level, right on the equator, and it's quite, the temperature is comfortable at that height, and but lovely weather, of course. The unfortunate thing is, which we didn't know at the time, was that the aircraft performance at 5,000 feet up, particularly Tiger Moth, is much different than it would be at sea level. But not knowing any difference, we were initiated into the joys of flying this Tiger Moth.
How did Trench start to teach you?
I'd have to look at my logbook to tell you that. He went through the usual drills. Can I just get... as far as I can remember, we must have had some ground instruction, obviously.
Do you remember anything about that? What would the ground instruction be?
Theory of flight, mainly. You know, the aerodynamics and a bit of wireless, a bit of the armament. I don't think the armament came into it at that stage. But looking at, this is November 1940.
Is that when you got there, or did you get there a bit earlier in October?
I'm just thinking, I said 23 EFTS, so it wasn't. Looking at my logbook, I see here on November the 15th is when we sat down. It was 30 EFTS.
I'll put that right in the catalogue.
Yeah, 30 EFTS.
But it was Eastley.
Oh, it's definitely Eastley. Right. And the squadron leader, I've got down here, Lovemore. I don't know why.
Now, tell us about, so you start on ground instruction, then what? What's the next phase of being taught?
It was a combination of ground school, you know, work it in. But being at that height and temperature, the flying was spread over the whole day. But I just, Lovemore seems, is the...
Don't worry about, tell us about your flying training. I mean, how did they start?
I'm just looking here. My first trip was on November the 15th by a squadron leader, Lovemore. He must have been the chief flying instructor. And it's broken down into air experience, familiarity with cockpit layout, which is effect of the controls, taxiing, straight and level flight and medium turns. That would be standard for most.
This is dual instruction in a Tiger
Moth. Oh, yes, and a Tiger Moth. I was in the, I can't remember, I was in the back seat or the front seat. Must have been in the back seat. And then the second trip was the next day, was, that only took 25 minutes, by the way. The second trip was 50 minutes, which was straight and level flight, which you've got, and turns. And then you progressed. They're all about an hour. And then that was the chief flying instructor, and then that goes on for quite a few hours. I went solo on the Tiger Moth after the first 6 days. 6 days, so 6 working days.
Had you been doing circuits and bumps?
In between time, you were doing...
Could you explain what circuits and bumps is? For
yeah,
people?
Well, I'll just have a quick read through. Straight and level flight, taking off under wind and gliding approaches and landing. And then that went on. That's what you call circuits and bumps. That went on for about 4 hours. And then... I went on for longer than that. I should think about 6 hours. My first solo came following that.
Now, what do you remember of your first solo?
First solo. I remember it quite clearly, actually. Squadron leader, the pilot, the initial instructor was Lovemore. He was obviously the chief flying instructor. He was vetting us initially to see if we could progress to the solo stage. So having got that, the first solo was, I found it quite exhilarating, actually, I suppose, because this is the thing that a young boy always strives to to fly an aircraft without anybody else looking over your shoulder, literally. Not that they did, but and to be passed out as confident to do just that. And like I say, I was told to the instructor got out and said, right, you can go solo now. And you tuck in his harness, and off you go. And he said, well, do a couple of circuits and landings, which you did. And that first trip was 25 minutes. And then you kept on doing these taking off and landings. And it was at that juncture, having gone solo, I had another trip with him lasting 20 minutes. That's the chief instructor. And then I was sort of let loose on the basis of you can go solo now. And then it was at that point that Le Port Trench took over to repeat the performance. It was all taking off into wind, crosswind, medium turns, steep turns, climbing turns. This is all going on to, you know, now to the 27th of November. It was constant repetition. Side slipping, I see here, comes in about the 20th day or the third week. Still on tight, side slipping seemed to be quite a popular approach because if you came in too high, you had to slip off, you know, you had to be able to get down on the.
Could you explain? People don't know what side slipping is now.
Well, side slipping, well, they don't do it nowadays, but, well, they do it on the smart. It's a means of reducing your height and speed. Predominantly reducing your height. What you do in actual fact, you point the aircraft one way and put the controls the opposite direction, so the aircraft has an exaggerated crabbing effect, and you're slipping down towards the runway, and take off the rudder to point it down the runway, you've lost quite a considerable. It was a means of approaching in a biplane, which you shouldn't really have to do, but being novices, we always came in too high or came in too fast, and this is a means of getting the speed down so you could approach. I think the landing speed, if I remember, was about 65 at that height, which was
Any other manoeuvres? Any stunting at all? You know,
no,
aerobatics rather than stunting.
I'm just looking down. That didn't come till fairly well on, actually, aerobatics. Steep turns. Spinning was another thing we did.
Tell us about spinning. How did you get into one? How did you get out of one?
Here we go. Serious. It wasn't until December the 4th, which is what? 15 days or more? From the 15th to the. That was the first spinning exercise. The spinning, what you do is you get up to height and you stall the aircraft. In order to stall the aircraft, you had to throttle aircraft back and keep the nose up, and eventually the speed obviously drops off, and when it's just before it actually finally stalls, you kick on rudder right or left, depending on which spin you want to do, right spin or left spin, and the aircraft goes into wings over and goes into this spiral dive, which is called a spin, and you're taught to recover it by centering the rudder and pushing the stick forward. That's what you do to get out. And as soon as it stops spinning, you ease on the power and you get away that way. Now, I did this spinning. It was not a very gentle spin, but when I went to do some verticommerce refresher pilot's training. When I retired from the Air Force, I went to a local flying club and I did a few hours on a Cessna, and I said to the guy, I've done all the circuits and things. I said, when do I do the spinning? And he looked at me. Now, this must have been about 1970-ish, so it's a big gap. 30 years difference. He said, spinning? He said, you must be ex-service, because we don't teach spinning anymore. He said, but I will show you. So we went up in a Cessna 175, which was specially stressed for aerobatics. And he said, righto, he said, spin it. So I did what I had been taught, pulled back, and this thing kicked around, and it did spin. But what frightened me out with more than anything was the rate that this thing didn't rotate. I felt as the biplane, yes, the biplane rotate very leisurely. This Cessna really wound up in terms of rotation speed. But the recovery was identical. So I came back, having said, well, I've spun it. So I felt more confident, but it was a thing you had to learn, and it's a thing we used to learn, but it transpired over the intervening 30-odd years. There have been more students killed in spinning exercises, because, I suppose, of the modern aeroplanes, that they didn't recommend it. Except they did do it at flying training school. I knew they did it in 1960-ish. They used to spin the jet provis, but they spun them from an awfully great height. You know, they got them up very high.
Plenty of recovery time.
Yeah. Plus the fact that they used to say if you're in a spin beyond a certain height, you get abandoned aircraft. I mean, that was just how serious it apparently came. But I went on to do these things, and eventually come the 30th of December, that was Christmas, so I did a bit of more time after that. I had to learn the fuel system as well, a lot of different aeroplanes, sorry.
You were just on the Tiger Moth, were you?
Yeah, we were just on the Tiger Moth. So
what did you think of the Tiger Moth? What was it like to fly? People go on about it, but what was so good about it?
Well, it was a very basic... Well, it was a robust aircraft, for starters. I mean, you could thump it on the ground, which, you know, the idea of teaching young people to fly this thing, not that we did it as a matter of purpose, but, I mean, there were the odd occasions when you misjudged things and you thumped it a bit. But never, all the time I was there, I finished the Tiger Moth December the 30th.
Was it a nice aircraft to fly?
Yes, it was nice. You had to fly it, literally. You had to put it in the right direction and keep a control over it. But once you got it trimmed, you could fly it with your finger, you know, literally. You're quite stable aircraft, mind you, bearing in mind where we were. We were equivalent of 10,000 feet up, you know, we were 5,000 feet above 5,000 feet ground level, so, and the weather was good and the winds were nice, so, and it was good, but we did a little aerobatics, not a great deal of it. We were showing how to loop, we were showing how to roll it, and because of its lack of power, you know, you had to be pretty precise, because it would drop out of the sky. You know, you only had a small horsepower engine. I can't remember what it was, actually. It was about 100 horsepower or something. No, it wasn't, probably not as much as that. But we did that, and we used to do a roll off the top of a loop, and that was about the extent of our flying. The steep turns are important, because you had to wind the thing up to get a really steep turn, and also they taught us, if I seem to remember, doing some steep turns low down, which is a thing you've got to practice, because you can be deceived, because you're subject to wind at low level, and you tend to get, I wouldn't say disoriented, it's probably not that, but there is a technique which serves you well in later years if you do have to get low down. But having